You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. While the Bush administration seems destined to launch a war with Iraq no matter what the cost, some people say a war is inevitable. Harper's Magazine publisher Rick MacArthur, the burgeoning peace movement, is drawing much more attention now than at similar points before the Vietnam War and the first Gulf War. Speaking with KPFK's Susie Weissman, MacArthur says he's not surprised at the Republican victory in the recent election, and he attributes it to the Democratic Party, no longer have room within it for anti-war politicians.
The only surprising thing to me is that the Democrats didn't do worse. I think they took a dive. And I think, broadly speaking, that the Democrats under Bill Clinton decided 10 years ago that they were going to be equal competitors with the Republicans in fundraising, and that the labor unions were tapped out, and that if they were going to compete head-to-head, they had to tap the same political action committees that the Republicans tapped. And you can see this literally. You can chart it from the moment that Clinton endorses NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
And decides to push NAFTA instead of national health care, instead of national health insurance, the cash registers start ringing at the Democratic National Committee, and suddenly corporations like American Express and General Electric are giving as much or close to as much money to the Dems as they are giving to the Republicans.
And both parties are beholden
right,
to them.
Once they had achieved parity, mm-hmm, with the Republicans in fundraising, and NAFTA was the key to it, the personality of the party changed completely, because a guy like Gephardt, who I think his instincts are pretty good, but wants to be president or wants to be an important person in the party, just realized he couldn't compete in terms of money. He ran out of money in the 88 campaign,
mm-hmm,
when he ran for president, because he just couldn't compete with the labor union money wasn't enough to compete nationally. And so what you've seen in the last few years, and you saw most dramatically on Tuesday, is a kind of stasis, which serves certain Democrats very well. They're perfectly happy with the status quo.
But
it's become as much a party of the party of the status quo. The Republicans are the radical party now.
Well, that's absolutely true, and they certainly know how to mobilize their base. The Democrats have forgotten how to do that.
Right. Well, I don't think they want to mobilize their base anymore, the Democrats. NAFTA and the PNTR, the Permanent Normal Trading Relations with China, essentially killed off the American Union movement. It's over. It's dead.
For the stage that we're in compared to where we were, let's say, as we were contemplating going into Vietnam, we've got a significant anti-war movement. They can mobilize, you know, tens of thousands and maybe even hundreds of thousands this early on. So it shows that there's some deep, you know, reservation among the American people.
Oh, yeah. And I'm hopeful that a popular movement is going to emerge against an imperialist foreign policy. But the problem there, again, is if there is a war, if we do invade Iraq, it's going to be over very fast in the short term. And it'll take Saddam will fall in 5 days. He's a paper tiger.
Mm-hmm.
They'll install another military dictator with a patina of democratic reform and so on. The Rendon group, the PR group the Pentagon uses, will equip everyone with little American flags when the American soldiers roll into Baghdad, and people will be left with the impression, the way they were left with the impression in Afghanistan, that it's a big success. When this or that Marine barracks is blown up
hit
down the road, it's going to be scattershot. It's not going to be like Vietnam with a full scale all-out combat scenario. It's going to be harder to mobilize against, because it's going to be bits and pieces, I think, and it's going to take a long time. I'm hopeful.
I'm speaking with Rick MacArthur. He's the publisher of Harper's Magazine and the author of The Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War. Well, Rick, I just want to go on to that, because as you've hinted, the it may be easy to overthrow Saddam Hussein. There's no exit strategy. The Cheney plan, which your magazine so brilliantly exposed in the October Harper's, really shows that there is this plan for an imperial occupation and perhaps recolonization of the area.
Right.
Cheney's interests in oil mean that perhaps he wants to have Halliburton pump the oil and deduct the cost of it from the cost of the occupation, which is a bold imperial drive. It seems almost, you know, it's almost surreal given the time that we're in that this kind of open, you know, that this kind of policy is openly discussed, planned for, and even they're discussing how much it will cost. But as you stated just a few minutes ago, it's extremely dangerous and will make the United States troops who are stationed there, you know, vulnerable to every kind of attack.
Sure. We've already gotten hit in Saudi Arabia. We got hit in Beirut 20 years ago when Reagan put troops in the barracks there. We got hit on the coal, got hit. We've got hit at the World Trade Center and at the Pentagon. They will hit back, and they'll find ways to shoot back at us. And it's going to be difficult and ugly, and then the American people are going to have to decide whether they want to have an imperial policy or not. What disappoints me, I guess, more than anything, aside from the lack of opposition from the Democrats, is the lack of opposition from the French and the Mexicans,
mm-hmm.
who ought to know better. You know, I was on a Canadian TV show the other night where I was up against some right-winger from the American Enterprise Institute. They mint these people. It's just amazing how many of them there are. And she's talking blithely, glibly about the occupation and establishing democracy and so on. And I said, have you read any history about the British and the French in the Middle East trying to control the Arabs, trying to run it directly,
mm-hmm.
with great enthusiasm? And are you aware that it failed? It didn't work. In the end, they had to pull out, and these things just don't seem to occur to them. I don't know where the historical consciousness of the country is, but you'd think that there was nothing ever happened before this.
Right. Let's see if we can end it on a happier note. What do you think will come of this? Because obviously you're painting doom and gloom, less political relevance for the political class, and perhaps some emerging movement. What do you think?
Well, all I can say is that it's got to come from the people, because it's not going to come from the two parties. The Political Action Committee system of financing the campaigns, which came out of the phony reforms in the 70s, has given the incumbents insurance like they've never had before. 99.5% of the House races went to incumbents.
Right.
That's worthy of the Soviet Communist Party Congress. Certain elements of the Democratic Party are perfectly happy with that arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
And so for anything to change, it's got to come from the people, which is traditionally where it comes from anyway, and even in better times and looser times. And for that, we're going to have to do some organizing and some thinking and some education. It's going to take a while, but eventually, I'm hoping that there's going to be a sort of an old-fashioned revolt against this whole crazy imperial policy.
Harper Magazine publisher Rick MacArthur speaking with KPFK's Susie Weissman. In Houston, Texas, the voices of peace come from areas of the city that are often underexplored by people who assume, perhaps, that peace is only for, well, the Pacifica listener. Peter Blackie of KPFT hit the streets to interview a white precinct judge at an NAACP mixer with black Republicans. They interview members of the youth hip-hop culture at a Houston club, and they employ local artists and hip-hop beats to render new perspectives on peace. KPFT news reporter Jackson Allers teams with Peter Blackie to bring you this work from Houston.
The war. The war. The war. The war. What do you think about, what do I think about the war? The war in Iran, oh, you mean the war on Africa, on Iraq, on India, on Asia? The war is taking place right now. We are in the war. The war is not only for the souls and the minds, but the war is for the land and the money and the power.
I'm so busy fighting the war within myself, I don't have time to think about the Bush War.
Business goes on as usual.
Like, we'll come about this war on Iraq that about to go into, but we've already given Bush the power as an American people to start the war. So how do you feel about war?
Well, to be honest, my feelings on the whole war thing, you know what I'm saying, with America involved, it's basically like, you know what I mean, I feel that a lot of times the government doesn't let on exactly the whole issue, you know what I'm saying, what exactly is going on. And I don't think their reasoning for going to war is fully justified.
I mean, honestly, I think it's a bunch of bullshit.
What you see is not necessarily what you get.
I mean, it's just, I haven't even really followed the news, because what we were just talking about is like the age that we're in. We're in the age of illusion.
Well, I think we should remember who is in our military. Who's going to die first? Our 18, 19, 20-year-olds. And I'm sure every mother and every father doesn't want to send their children there. So let's have evidence that they are a threat to us before we have our kids on the front line. I don't want to send them there unless we know that.
Very profound. So would you say then that you're not completely sure that there is enough evidence to attack?
Well, certainly there's not enough yet. He has to show us more evidence. There may be. And if he does have nuclear weapons, perhaps we should preempt him and take him out. But it would be the first time ever that we attacked another country without provocation.
I don't like the fact that they gave Bush that power, because I have a brother that was in the service, and I wouldn't want him to go just because Bush said he has to, and I don't trust Bush.
So if you could ask President Bush any question right now, what would it be?
Why Saddam?
Okay. As in the past, we have, bombarded with our own supremacy clause, if you will. And I would just like to say that any kind of, like, W. Bush trying to repeat his daddy's work is something that I'm not going to vote for, nor did I. Though my father's Republican, and I respect the conservative point of view. A war that is not on our territory, that has been begun by some freelance terrorist, is nothing to start a globalization, worldwide, World War III, if you know what I mean. And nuclear devastation is imminent. In such cases, I am full-fledgedly and wholeheartedly against this. I am incredibly pissed off. And So
if this microphone was a direct link to George W., what would you have to say to him?
I would say, W., consult somebody other than your daddy. And if you believe that your daddy did what was right, maybe reconsider and listen to that thing in your head that's rattling called your ego, which should be rationally making decisions. Don't listen to what your nice little polls are saying about this war.
I'm saying I think I have faith. I guess I don't have. Mr. Contrast, what's your interpretation? What do you think of the war?
Money and power, Aquarian age, illusion, fulfillment of prophecy. more so the sins of the father, Daddy Bush, affecting the son.
True. Very poignant words. And I also believe that it's a personal vendetta, family issue, more than a national.
Produced by Jackson Allers and Peter Blackie at Houston's KPFT. For the past several weeks, freelance journalist Jeremy Scahill's reports from Iraq have aired on this program on Democracy Now! And on his website, iraqjournal.org. We present now a speech he gave to a group of students at St. Peter's College in New Jersey on the topic of Iraq and the danger of American foreign policy.
To begin with Iraq and to understand the current situation with an unprecedented regime of economic sanctions that are solely responsible for an overwhelming majority of the suffering in Iraq, it's important to go back to the so-called Gulf War. I don't mean to be rhetorical, but I don't call it a war, I call it a massacre, and I don't think that that's an engagement in rhetoric, because when you have such an unbalanced show of force against a country with so many of the casualties, and they shouldn't even be called casualties, what they are is killings and deaths, torture and injury. When you have such an imbalance of victims on one side, and there were Americans who died, but the numbers were overwhelmingly on the Iraqi side, it's important to go back to that massacre, actually toward the end of it. In February of 1991, the United States had debated moving from the south of Iraq north to go and take Baghdad with ground troops. But a decision was made not to do that. But the United States did give the Iraqi government and military, which had shown nominal signs of independence, a parting gesture that resulted in many hundreds, perhaps thousands of deaths. And some people may be familiar with the story, but it's worth talking about. It's the story of what we know as the Highway of Death. As the massacre was coming to an end, Iraqi soldiers and civilians were fleeing Kuwait. The United States had defeated the Iraqi military and Iraqi civilians. And as they were fleeing, the United States flew bombers in, and they bombed the highway leading out of Basra, which is in the south of Iraq and which was the city most heavily bombed by the United States during the Gulf massacre. And as they were fleeing Kuwait on the Basra highway, the United States came in and dropped bombs in front of them and dropped bombs behind them, and they were trapped. And many veterans, U.S. veterans, in congressional testimony and interviews following the Highway of Death described what happened after that as a turkey shoot. As the civilians and soldiers began fleeing Kuwait in caravans of trucks, some of them on foot, the United States brought in ground troops, and they opened fire on the fleeing civilians and soldiers. U.S. planes bombed with depleted uranium-tipped bombs. Depleted uranium being nuclear waste, the most potent coating that you can put on a bullet known to modern warfare. And they did this turkey shoot. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of people were killed. And one veteran of that turkey shoot, his job was to drive a Bradley armored vehicle, like a tank with a big shovel on the front of it. And he admitted to actually burying soldiers alive, burying people alive that were on the Highway of Death. And he wrote a letter back to his aunt that was published in the New York Times in 1995. And in that letter, he said, killing Iraqis was real hard at first, but after the first time, it got easy. And his name is Timothy McVeigh. The question that needs to be posed in the context about Iraq, does it get easier after the first time to kill all these people around the world? That is the central question for the policymakers in Washington today and for those who carry it out. The people of Iraq continue to live under U.S. bombardment. The war has not ended against Iraq. The sanctions certainly are economic warfare, but we also, pardon my term, the United States government also continues to bomb Iraq almost daily under the guise of so-called no-fly zones, which I'm sure all of us have heard of. And the way that the corporate media in this country speak about these no-fly zones is that they're United Nations enforced. That's a lie. They're not United Nations enforced. The United Nations never approved of them. There are three countries in the world that approve of the so-called no-fly zones: the United States, Britain, and Turkey, from which the United States and British planes fly out to bomb the north of Iraq and the south of Iraq. Ostensibly, these no-fly zones were put in place to defend the Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south, but the United States' record on defending the rights of the opposition in Iraq is scandalous, to say the least. 2 weeks ago, the United States dropped 81 missiles in one flying mission on Iraq, not a scant mention in the press. The United States' rhetoric, from the top to the bottom of the government, is always rooted in some humanitarian justification. Terms like national sovereignty were thrown out regarding Kuwait, put into the mix. All of a sudden, the United States is very concerned about the fate of the ethnic Albanians living in Kosovo, but the U.S. record on defending their rights is shameful. When there was a nonviolent movement in Kosovo to try to stop Serb repression, the United States was silent. When the Shiites in the south of Iraq cried out for help, even during the Gulf massacre, the United States was silent. Same with the Kurds in the north. When Turkey engaged in its ethnic cleansing campaign against the Kurds, and they regularly invade Iraqi's Kurdish population as well in the north of the country, some people would say the United States did nothing. That's not true. The United States helped to make it possible. 46,000 Kurds have been killed by the Turkish government. That's ethnic cleansing. But the United States in 1994, which was the height of the crackdown on the Kurds in Turkey, made Turkey the number one importer of arms in the world. U.S. corporations sold the very weapons that were used to engage in ethnic cleansing in Turkey. The United States speaks a strong rhetoric about sovereignty, as was the case regarding the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. But let's talk about the U.S. record on sovereignty. Did the United States have concerns for sovereignty when they aided the cabal that overthrew the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Haiti? When they overthrew the government of Jacobo Arbenz in 1954, the Dulles cabal and others from the intelligentsia in the United States, one of the first overt acts of the Central Intelligence Agency? Did the United States have concern about sovereignty when it invaded Panama, when it backed repressive death squads in Nicaragua and El Salvador, when it backed the Indonesian military and its ongoing massacre of the people of East Timor? Where were the concerns about national sovereignty then? And those are the questions we need to ask when we look at countries that we're told are our enemies.
Freelance reporter Jeremy Scahill speaking at St. Peter's College in Jersey City, New Jersey.
Missiles flying in the third world towards the people stranded on their knees. Bombs falling over Baghdad, killing children who are starving by degrees. There are those of us who'd question, what's the goal and what's the cost? 600,000 dead malnourished children, a UN-sanctioned holocaust. Missiles flying in the third world, from Hanoi to Wounded Knee. Bombs falling over Baghdad, and each one shouts, democracy. Contras, kings and generals, brandish stars and stripes, from Rangoon to Los Angeles, selling oil, guns, and crack pipes. Missiles flying in the third world, and each one will kill a child. Bombs falling over Baghdad, and hunger and death is running wild. We had to destroy the village in order to save it, to help this jungle grow. First we had to pave it. fits and starts are everywhere. From the mountains of Chiapas to the streets of Central Square, empires fall. This one will too. So here's to the day when this one is through.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our engineer today was Rolando Arrieta. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett of KPFA and Laurel Padgett-Seekins. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers, Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org. or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.